From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. In the U.S. Senate today, former President Trump's legal team began its defense, arguing that Trump should not be convicted of inciting the deadly insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th.
Contrast the president's repeated condemnations of violence with the rhetoric from his opponents.
Republicans stand for law and order, and we stand for justice.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be.
My administration will always stand against...
All right, it's time for our Friday Politics Roundtable, and for that we have with us Darlene Superville, who is a White House reporter for the Associated Press, and Rick Klein, who is the political director for ABC. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Yes. So Trump's lawyers are under pressure to do better than they did on Tuesday when they meandered during their presentation on whether this trial was constitutional. Darlene, did they make a stronger start today?
Yes, they appear to have made a stronger start today. We have heard a couple of arguments from the defense team. One, that the trial itself is unconstitutional. Two, the president is not responsible for what other people did when they went up to the Capitol on January 6th. He can't be held responsible for that. And the other argument they're making is they've been showing a series of stitched-together video clips of prominent Democrats using the word fight in various constructions to kind of counter the videos that we saw from the House Democratic impeachment managers when they showed video of former President Trump at the rally outside the White House on January 6th, where he told his supporters to fight like hell. So they're trying to make an equivalency argument there.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of folks, including former Obama advisor David Axelrod, actually tweeted that he feels like this whole defense is kind of a whataboutism defense. Rick, three Republican senators who are supposed to be impartial jurors actually met with Trump's lawyers last night to talk strategy. One of them was Mike Lee of Utah, who actually accidentally received a phone call from Trump during the insurrection. What should we make of this? Journalist Abby Phillips says the meeting is significant because it shows Republicans are worried. What are your thoughts?
Look, it's one of those many examples about how strange this whole thing is. You have senators who are judge and jury, but also policing their own conduct. And by the way, many of them are witnesses, including Senator Lee, who spoke up at the trial to try to set the record straight on a particular item attributed to him. I don't think it's necessarily a statement of concern on the part of senators. It definitely is a statement of coordination, which is, you know, unusual to say the best, to say the least, but also not necessarily wholly inappropriate given the political circumstances. I think it also just reminds us that most Republicans are going to back President Trump on this. And I think a lot of the defense today is actually designed to make them feel better about the vote that they're about to cast to acquit the president.
Well, Darlene, I think at this point, you know, Rick is right. Even Democrats would admit that they're unlikely to get a conviction here. But do you think that when this is all said and done, that it will be a loss for Democrats? I mean, are there ways in which they will have accomplished something here?
Sure. With the presentation we saw earlier this week from the House Democratic managers and the video, that very harrowing, scary, chilling video of people literally running for their lives and hiding in conference rooms. And you saw that video of Senator Romney, for example, spinning on his heels and running in the other direction from the mob. So for people who have been watching that on television, that is going to stick with them, and that is where I think Democrats will have, you know, made their case.
Mm-hmm. Rick, I wonder if it's resonating even with some Republicans outside of the Senate. A potential 2024 GOP presidential candidate, former ambassador and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, told Politico that we need to acknowledge that President Trump let us down. These are her words, that he went down a path that he shouldn't have. We shouldn't have followed him. And then about him running in 2024, she said, I don't think he's going to be in the picture. I don't think he can. He's fallen so far. What do you think that tells us about where things stand in the Republican Party?
Well, 2 points. It's notable to have former Governor Haley, former Ambassador Haley, who's herself very likely to be a candidate in 2024, come out that forcefully. It's also notable that interview took place a couple of weeks ago. And I wonder if she would say the same things now, because some Republicans who were speaking quite freely about a post-Trump era a month ago aren't quite saying the same thing right now. You've seen, if anything, a coalescing of Trumpism behind the former president. And I wonder if as many Republicans are ready to abandon him. They may get there eventually, but they're not quite there. And I think as much as we start thinking about the 2024 pressures, there's going to be different dynamics at play.
Okay, I want to talk with both of you all about something else that we're following, and that's the reopening of schools in the country. President Biden promised to reopen schools within 100 days. This is a contentious issue. I mean, the president is caught between teachers' unions and frustrated parents. This could actually be one of the first promises that President Biden breaks. What's the administration saying about this now, Darlene? How are they proposing opening schools safely?
Well, we are awaiting guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that is supposed to be issued today that will provide schools with recommendations and guidelines for how they can reopen safely. So the White House is, in some sense, punting to the CDC on this issue because, as you mentioned, I mean, this is becoming a really big contentious issue, and the president is finding himself under increasing pressure to get these schools opened, and it's something that hasn't happened yet. And they talk a lot about deferring to the science and the public health experts, and so that's where the CDC guidance is coming into play today on this issue.
Right. So many considerations to take in on this. Well, since he took office, President Biden has really largely stayed out of the political fray. But last night, he took aim at the Trump administration's vaccine rollout in particular. Let's listen.
When I took office just 3 weeks ago, this country did not have a plan or enough vaccines or people to vaccinate Americans. All Americans, any time, at any point in 2021.
This morning, Biden said that he hopes every American can get vaccinated by the end of the summer. But he says that that's going to take a lot of time. Is Biden beginning to run into some political realities, Rick? I mean, on how hard it's going to be to actually turn the corner on this pandemic?
There's no question that the practical realities of vaccine production, the logistical realities, are running into these political promises. And that's why you see the administration walking back the bold promises about school reopenings, the promises about vaccinations. Part of it may be that they inherited a worse mess than they thought. Part of it really is just the physical limitations of production, the realities of what it takes to get those vaccines into people's arms. It's just very complicated. And one thing to campaign on issues like this, it's quite another to enact it. And I think the White House, the task force, are all finding that out right now in real time.
Rick, do you think he's overpromising?
I think he's doing his best to walk back some of the initial promises, to kind of shade them a little bit, to stop that, because he recognizes that's one of the things he was elected to do, frankly, is to not make this about happy talk, to not downplay the threats of the virus. He brings his own dose of optimism, but it has to be tempered with real realities, because people have experienced this for a year, and guess what? They're really sick of it, and they want to see political leadership deliver.
Well, Darlene, one of the other political realities the president is facing now is whether or not he's going to be able to get this coronavirus relief bill through the Senate. Where are we on the $15 an hour federal minimum wage? It looks like it might fall by the wayside here. Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, she's a moderate Democrat, is saying she's opposed to it. Senator Joe Manchin, another moderate Democrat from West Virginia, has said similar things. Where do we stand?
Well, it very well may have to be removed from the bill, and the vice president said as much, I believe it was over the weekend, last weekend, in an interview with CBS News, that he doesn't think the $15 minimum wage proposal will survive. The bill and its elements are working through various committees in the House, and we'll have to wait and see what emerges. But at this point, if you have the president of the United States sort of resigned to the fact that one of the a big thing that he's interested in, raising the minimum wage to $15, may not survive, then it very well, the bill may come out and it may not be in there.
And Rick, real quick on the asylum issue here. The Biden administration is going to be phasing in a new asylum process next week to end the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy. You know, that's where asylum seekers have to wait out their application in Mexico. Many, of course, got stuck there and were living in just terrible camps. It looks like about 300 people per day from just a huge backlog are going to be allowed in for court proceedings. What does that tell you about what Biden is doing on this issue?
It's another example of governing realities running into what campaign promises would suggest. These are not easy issues, and it's not easy to unwind 4 years' worth of policy with the executive pens. And look, there's been so much action at the executive order level. He's really taxed portions of the administration. Bottom line is there's only so much processing of actual human beings that can happen day by day.
All right, Rick Klein, political director for ABC News, and Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Great to have you both today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the single people, we know it can be hard to date these days. It used to be easier before this pandemic, right? You at least felt there was a chance serendipity could strike at a bar or a coffee shop. Well, our next guest says hope is not lost. You can still find someone. There is still a dating scene. You just have to know how to navigate it. Damona Hoffman is a certified dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast, and she joins us now. Welcome, Damona.
No, thank you for having me. I'm ready to spread some hope. Valentine's Day's coming.
I know. Spread some hope, girl. Okay. You are a dating coach. You've heard the nightmares people are having these days, specifically with dating apps. The big one is that there's so much choice that if your goal is to settle down, it's kind of hard to navigate the weeds, so to speak, to find a person that's aligned with you. But you have a formula you recommend, and it's called the 3 C's. Can you explain what those are?
The 3 C's are your must-have profile photos. You have to have color, and that's psychological. It's getting that person to stop and pay attention and actually go deeper into your profile to read more about you and see your other photos. It's context, telling your life story visually through your photos. You know, we ain't got a lot of time. We're living this Instagram life, so people make their decisions very quickly. Between 5 and 7 seconds is all they give you for the amount of time to decide if they want to match or not. And then you have to have that 3rd C, which is character. That's the one most people miss. And that's really showing your personality through your profile, too.
Oh, this is all interesting because it's very visual, as you said. But there is one tip of yours that really got me, and it's forget the spark. Listen, if there is one piece of advice from our chat that people need to hear, it is really this one. You say a spark is not an indication that you and a person are a match. How can this be, Damona? I mean, what else do we go by?
It actually can be a negative thing to follow the spark, because what we're reacting to there is chemical. It's those initial butterflies. It's not the deeper stuff that really makes you bonded to a person. And the factors of long-term compatibility that I see in my successful long-term relationship clients are understanding that you have the same values, goals for the future, communication style and conflict resolution and mutual respect. And you can't tell that from a photo, and you certainly can't tell that on a first date.
Because spark can be built. You're saying as you become more aligned with someone, as you get to know them, the building of attraction can happen. It's not always just that first meeting, that first photo that you might see on an app.
It has to build. It has to build. I've been with my husband for 17 years, and I'm more curious about him now than I even was when we first met. And we are so much more bonded, even going through the pandemic. And that's what I want for all of my clients, and why I tell them to lead with curiosity on those first few dates, not with chemistry, but at the end of the date, you ask yourself, what am I still curious to know about this person? And would I be able to discover more if we spent one more date together, not playing all the way ahead to marriage and what these happy ending is down the road, but just what's that next step?
What is that next step? Okay, so Valentine's Day, as you said, is this Sunday. It really is a dreaded holiday. It's not even a holiday. I don't even know what you would call it. But for so many people, there's a lot of pressure around it to celebrate it. You're actually encouraging singles to turn it into an extra special self-care Sunday. What tips do you have for that?
Oh, there are so many ways to honor yourself. And really, whether you're single or in a relationship, if you are coming to the table as a whole person who feels like their needs are getting met by themselves, then that gives you more to offer the other person rather than feeling like you're coming from a deficit of needing someone to complete you. So there's so many ways that you can honor yourself, and it's different for everyone. I love music. That really elevates my mood. I also love exercise. So my Peloton bike is my best friend because I get both of those needs met. Also community. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not in a relationship right now, if you can be in community, even virtually, with people that you love this Valentine's Day, that will remind you of the true reason for the season. And it's just to celebrate love in all forms.
Oh, I love that. And that could work for couples too, because, you know, there'll be no fancy restaurant dinners or shows or stuff like that. I mean, you could spend it as a time to connect maybe on Zoom or something with the people you love.
That's exactly what I'm doing, actually, with two other couples that we are friends with. My husband and I are doing a virtual escape room, which might not sound sexy, but I'll tell you.
No, that sounds fun. It's
fun. And I mean, one, you have to be able to laugh and have fun with your partner, but also the problem solving element can make you feel more bonded to someone because you have to communicate and work together to find a way out. So I'm really looking forward to spending my Valentine's Day that way.
Damona Hoffman is a certified dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast. Thank you so much, Damona, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
Thank you. Same to you, Tanya.
And we want to know about your dating experiences in this pandemic. What's worked? What hasn't? Share your stories with us at hereandnow.org, or you can leave us a voice message at 617-358-0397.
If you are on social media looking for love, you may have seen that Facebook announced it would target more debunked claims about the coronavirus, like that it was man-made or that masks don't prevent transmission. Both of those are, of course, false. Let's take a look at the week in social media with Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, how's it going? What are you seeing about Facebook getting tougher on COVID-19 conspiracies?
It has taken so many years to get to this point. It's been a really difficult struggle. And I'm really just going to point to the COVID pandemic that has really pushed Facebook and other social media platforms to take some action about misinformation, particularly when it comes to anti-vaxxers putting out misinformation. So I know you would have known if you've ever been searching for COVID-19 or vaccine information, whatever platform you're on will pop up, give you the CDC website, maybe the WHO website. So that has been in place for several months now. But now Facebook has gone one step further. They are going to remove your posts. They will remove you as a group. And they are saying this is part of a big campaign to help the COVID vaccination campaign. So they're giving out free ads to health authorities. They're also encouraging people to find out where can you get vaccinated. Go on to Facebook or Instagram. They may well be able to direct you in the right place. And then also just policing this misinformation. It is a huge endeavor to ban all anti-vaxxers who are posting misinformation, all the groups who are doing that. And Deb sums up the real difficulty. She posted underneath Facebook's post this week, "I am worried that you are too late. You let the disinformation go on for too long. Many will not be coming back, and this is all on you." Peter, it's a huge enterprise, but now they're having zero tolerance. Let's see how that works out.
Yeah, well, that's good because we are fans of solid information here. There's another story that has been trending this week about Tessica Brown. Last month, the 40-year-old from Louisiana ran out of hairspray and decided to use Gorilla Glue on her hair instead. And then a week later, in a panic, she turned to social media for help because she couldn't get it out. And Femi, I saw you tweeting about this story.
I did, and as Tessica said herself in her TikTok video, bad, bad, bad idea. Let me give you an idea of what her head looked like. You know those little dollies where your hair gets painted on? And it was solid. So in her first TikTok video, she tapped her head in. It sounded like it was a rock. So people were invested in her story. Oof. There was one Instagram video that's had 4 million views. People were suggesting things. Chelsea app said acetone and water. that will make a glue removing adhesive. People were suggesting coconut oil and tea tree oil. People were piling in. There was a lot of laughter and confusion. How on earth can you mix up a heavy duty adhesive with a styling product? People weren't buying that. They thought maybe she was out there trying to get the likes and the views. But it was a real dilemma. And I think what made this such an incredible story to follow, very visual updates. Everybody had an opinion. And there was also, Peter, and this is sad, but we know this is really true on social media, some bullying. So I know you've got a little bite so that Tessica can explain how much bullying she received too online.
Well, I do. This is her speaking to Entertainment Tonight earlier this week.
I'm usually the person that I don't care, you know, what people say. You know, I just move at my own pace. You know, I don't care what people say. But it's just getting to the point where, you know, people are on TV saying stuff about me. You don't even know me.
You know, Femi, a lot of times you and I will talk about some of the stories that are trending on social media, and we will be laughing about them. But this is sort of a tough one, isn't it? What do you think we can learn here?
I think it's borderline, because you can see it's slapstick. The fact that you're tapping your head and it sounds like it's a brick wall, that's slapstick, until you realize that Tessica is in pain. She went to the ER, she couldn't get some help. And then a plastic surgeon in LA offered some help. So it's the internet coming to the rescue at the same time as mocking and bullying you. So you see the light and the dark. And people also recognize that this was bullying and that she really did need help. She wasn't doing it for attention. That is the takeaway, is that in the same place that you can find help, you'll also find people who delight in the fact that you are in a very serious situation. It does have a happy ending so far, Peter.
The internet can be a scary place. All right, Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you as always. Have a great weekend. Happy Friday, Femi.
Thank you. Take care.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
My name is Peter Sagal, and I'm here to interrupt your very serious NPR podcast to tell you about another NPR podcast, mainly mine, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Chances are that right now you're enjoying an earnest, serious treatment of some serious topic in the news, or perhaps history or science. That's great, really. Well, that's not what we do, because people cannot live on serious alone. Listen now to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
Take a moment to reflect on the life of a legendary figure in jazz. Chick Corea was a keyboardist, composer, and band leader whose work touched on many genres from classical to Latin jazz. He died earlier this week from a rare form of cancer. He was 79. Bassist Christian McBride collaborated with Corea for more than two decades. He's also the host of NPR's Jazz Night in America. He joins us now. And Christian, welcome. I know so many people in the music world are so sad today. How are you doing?
I feel like the rest of them. You know, we're all sad together, still in shock, still pretty numb from this news, because most of us had no idea that he was ill.
Chick Corea was so well known for collaborating with other artists, you included. One of his early works was on Miles Davis's jazz fusion album, Bitches Brew. Let's listen to some of that. Christian, can you talk about Chick Corea, the collaborator? What was he like?
Chick Corea, the collaborator. One thing about Chick is that he was the musician's musician. in that he was always open to ideas, suggestions. He was one of the most celebrated and prolific composers in any style of music. So a lot of his music was already thoroughly constructed. But the times I worked with him, he was always open to making a part more specific to a particular player. And you know, he was... Now, if he's like that with his own music, playing with other people in their groups, he was just always the ultimate side man, the musician's musician.
Hmm. So for you personally, what did it feel like when you were up there playing with him?
It felt for me the way it felt for the listener watching Chick play, you know, because even though I had a chance to work with him very closely for so long, I never stopped being a fan. So I never took him for granted. You know, I got to play with Chick quite a bit, but every single gig I would look over and be like, man, that's Chick Corea, you know. So I never stopped being a fan.
Well, as I'm sure you know, every Thanksgiving, NPR's All Things Considered talks with musicians about artists that they're thankful for. And in 2019, the rapper LaKaylee47 thanked Chick Corea. And then here he is now responding to her.
It's deeply satisfying, really. And it's a testament to all of us as artists, that we're able to connect like that, that we're able to connect on a wavelength of creativity.
I'm sure it's nice to hear his voice there for you. But why do you think his music did resonate with so many different people and with different artists?
Because he had no agenda. He wrote music strictly from the joy of creating. And I actually find that to be somewhat, I don't want to say rare, but it's unusual when you meet someone who writes music simply because they love writing and playing and performing and touching people. That was his objective. You know, he said, I want people to feel this music. He really wanted his music to be enjoyed by everyone.
Bassist Christian McBride, host of NPR's Jazz Night in America, remembering the legendary Chick Corea, who died this week at 79. Christian, thank you for your time, and I'm sorry that you've lost your friend.
Thank you.
This week, President Biden took a virtual tour of a mass vaccination site in Glendale, Arizona. He told the state health director that what the organizers were doing at the Arizona Cardinals football stadium can be a model for the country.
I got a call during the Super Bowl from the commissioner of football and offering us, the federal government, the 30 major stadiums. So I think they're going to be coming to you to look at how you did it, because you're doing such a great job.
I was also at the stadium earlier that day to get a tour from Arizona State University's David Thomas. He's the man in charge of making sure this site runs smoothly.
This is the site of Arizona's first mass vaccination pod, and it's incredibly efficient. We're actually running now at a rate of, there's a vaccination every 10 seconds on
really?
The site.
Yeah. We're standing on a black ocean of asphalt. On a Cardinals game day, thousands of tailgating fans would be in this parking lot to throw down hot dogs and beer. Today is anything but a game. Car after car after car after car rolls up 24 hours a day, each in search of a COVID vaccine.
How would you describe the demand?
Well, the demand is very high, but we're operating very efficiently, so we don't expect to see lines here. Our average wait time on this site is actually 36 minutes.
From the time you pull up to the time you leave, 36 minutes.
That's correct. That's the average.
Okay. Can we maybe get a little
walk?
Bit closer?
Yeah, we're going to walk, and I'm going to walk you through the process, and you're going to get to observe the patients as they come in. Again, this is just like entering a doctor's office, except everybody's doing it in their vehicle.
The first stop is at a drive-through registration tent, where volunteers confirm that each patient has an appointment. From there, they drive on. Thomas says the next tent is where the magic happens.
So this can be quite an emotional place. We have people that are coming here. They've spent a year dealing with COVID, and they are getting, in most cases, their first injection. There can be quite the emotional response. This is like the sign of hope, like they can see the end of this thing. We have had people that have literally broken into tears. We've had others that have given us gifts. There's just a tremendous outpouring of gratitude. Thank you so much for what you're doing, because this is the place where there is this recognition that I think we've just turned a corner.
How does it feel for you to be a part of that?
I can't describe it. There's no words for how valuable these people are on this pavement right now, giving these vaccines to make our community whole again.
It is a moment that everybody in this country has been waiting for. Is this the light that's at the end of the tunnel? We have cars are in lines, pulling through the tents. Looks like there's a nurse or someone with a red vest on there who's getting the injection into somebody's arm in the driver's seat.
Yeah. Every 10 seconds, somebody leaves this tent that has their vaccine. And every 10 seconds, somebody else is now able to think about, I can go visit my family. I might be able to travel. I might be able to go back into the office.
Day in and day out, 24
hours.
Day in
and day out, 24/7. That's what's happening at this location.
And that's where I met William Howard and his wife in a cherry red Dodge pickup. His sleeve is rolled up, and a nurse has a needle in her hand.
Yeah, everything went well with your guys' first dose. Can I see your little cards there?
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is the 75-year-old's second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. He's in a playful mood as the jab goes in.
That's a piece of cake.
All right.
Well, I had to look away.
Feel that, little lady.
Everyone has to wait at least 15 minutes in the parking lot to see if they're allergic to the shot, so Howard pulls over and turns off his truck.
It was incredibly smooth. I'm a general contractor. I wish I could get my subcontractors to be this smooth.
So how does it feel? I mean, it feels smooth and great, but how do you feel today getting this second shot? What does it mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. I mean, especially at my age. And I'm diabetic, type 2, so it's rewarding. Yeah. I'm excited. I still work every day, and we have a blessed life, literally.
Yeah.
And this just makes it a little bit better.
More than 195,000 people, just like William Howard, have come through this site since it started operating last month. A second location across town recently opened, and organizers say it's getting shots out at a similar rate. But there are real problems with this system. If you don't have a car, it's nearly impossible to get to a football stadium on the outskirts of a sprawling megacity like Phoenix. And like elsewhere across the country, the reservation system to make an appointment has been a nightmare.
It's hard to get into the site.
That's Tom Schifferer, who just got his first shot. His wife, Kathy, is in the passenger seat.
I bet you we typed in 500 times to get finally one.
That must have taken days.
I just keep doing it over and over.
When we get to sit on the couch, start
tapping on the iPad.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask how old are both of you?
75 tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations. Happy birthday. And Kathy is about to turn 74. She's eligible to get a vaccine under the state's rules, but she's leaving here without one.
And Kathy didn't get hers today.
Oh, really?
No.
Why not?
Because they couldn't do extra.
Oh. No walk-ins.
It is beyond frustrating. On some days, passengers who don't have appointments can get a shot if they come along in the car. In other days, they can't. Dr. Kara Crist runs the state of Arizona's health department.
So that's a day-by-day clinical decision that's made by the team on site. We do try to accommodate if there are individuals in the car, because we know if they're a caretaker or a family member, they could put that vulnerable Arizonan at risk. However, we do have limited doses. So what we've been telling everybody is we offer that when it's clinically appropriate and we have vaccine available, but don't come expecting to have people who don't have an appointment to get a vaccine.
Another problem Dr. Crist is dealing with is equity. For the first time this week, the state released information about who is getting vaccinated. At last count, 48% have been white, 8% Latino, and just 1.4% black. For more than a third of the doses, there was no information about race or ethnicity. I spoke with one volunteer who worked at a vaccination center who said she was told by the organizers not to bother asking people about race or ethnicity when she entered their personal data into the system. Here's Dr. Crist.
No, so that shouldn't be the policy. They should ask everyone, and whether somebody wants to give up that information is then based on that individual's, you know, personal privacy. But we would have to do that, because I have not heard that here at the site.
How can you improve it? Because the data that did come out show that still a disproportionate number of white people are getting the vaccine, for instance, and fewer Latinos and black people.
So as you're looking at the data, we caution anybody to put the demographic data of the general population over the very strict phases that we have been following here in Arizona. That demographic information should change as we get more into the general population.
What do you mean by that?
So when you restrict by age or you restrict by profession, that's going to skew your demographics.
Although once you move into the general population, you'll still have to make efforts to reach those people. Otherwise, the numbers will likely stay disproportionate.
Yeah, so there's already a lot of efforts that are going on to make sure that as we get expanded vaccine, that we are moving into those hardest hit and vulnerable communities to make sure that we're communicating that the vaccine is safe and effective, that we're getting vaccine out into those communities to, you know, remove any barriers that there may be, like transportation to vaccine sites, and making sure that we're engaging with local trusted leaders and providers to get the vaccine out and meet people where they are.
So what's the timeline for that? Because as you know, time is of the essence to try to get ahead of these mutations and the variants that are popping up. How quickly will you be doing that?
So I think our limitation really is the amount of vaccine that we have. And so, you know, as we get more vaccine, we'll be able to expand those opportunities around the state, but our barrier is the amount of vaccine.
Well, couldn't you take 30% of what you do here and redistribute it around to other places?
So there are things that we are doing. There are allocations that go to pharmacies in high-risk areas as well as community health centers. They have them. What we've identified is it's just not as an efficient process as getting it out here to the stadium.
So the state will focus on mass vaccination sites like the one here at the football stadium.
You guys feeling okay?
At the final stop, a volunteer asks a patient one last set of questions before he takes off.
Feeling dizzy, lightheaded, any blurry vision?
No.
Awesome. All right, your 15 minutes are up. You guys are good to go.
And with that, one more lucky person drives back into the world a little more protected from a virus that is still killing thousands of Americans every day.
A new documentary puts the spotlight back on the Princess of Pop. The New York Times presents Framing Britney Spears. It explores the media's treatment of Spears during the height of her career and the fans that are now concerned for her well-being. They want her released from her father's legal conservatorship. It's an ongoing battle. Just yesterday, a judge ruled against Spears' father in a matter regarding her finances. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to talk more about the documentary. And Eric, the media was so invasive and inappropriate in covering Britney Spears' life. We see that in this documentary, as in this early interview.
Everyone's talking about it.
Why?
Well, your breasts.
My breasts.
You seem to get furious when a talk show host comes up with this subject.
Yeah. Eric, I mean, an interviewer asking her about her breasts. I remember almost all of these kinds of interviews with her. And this retrospective, especially as a journalist, is downright horrifying.
Well, it's interesting. You know, half of it is about making the case that we should take a closer look at how Britney Spears was treated, how she had to deal with sexist interviewers, she had to deal with the misogyny of the record industry, she had to deal with intrusive paparazzi. There's some really sort of embarrassing clips of Diane Sawyer playing a clip from a politician who said that she would rather shoot Britney Spears in the head than have her daughters be influenced by her. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the interview clips, you know, Britney Spears is crying, you know, and so you really get a sense that she had to deal with a lot in building her career, stuff that male pop singers didn't have to deal with.
Right. Well, we all watched Spears' life publicly unravel. I mean, the media was relentless in sharing almost every detail they could find about her relationship with Justin Timberlake, her marriage to Kevin Federline, which fell apart. She lost custody of her kids during the height of this media spectacle. We now have the language and better understanding of mental illness in general. How well do you think the documentary gets into this?
Not well at all, unfortunately. I think that's one of the big problems with the documentary. What kind of breakdown did she have when she decided to shave off all her hair? When she got divorced, why did her ex-husband get custody of her children? Because in America, there seems to be a preponderance towards placing children with their mother. When a judge decided to create the situation where she would be monitored by a conservator, her father was the one who was named as one of the conservators. according to the documentary, he hadn't really been as close to her as her mother. So why wasn't her mother a part of this process? There are a lot of questions that were raised by the circumstances that the doc doesn't really answer. And you don't really get a sense of Britney Spears. You know, of course, she didn't cooperate with the documentary, but this film, and sort of implying that all of these pernicious forces outside of her are taking advantage of her or unfairly criticizing her or unfairly trying to get a piece of her, overlooks the fact that she helped create this pop success and that she had a hand in what it was saying to the world. And that's another piece that's missing.
Well, this is the whole reasoning, though, for the Free Britney movement, right? Because fans feel like we're not hearing from her and we're not seeing more of her talking out about herself and who she is because of her father's conservatorship over her. But there's so much that we don't know about that situation, as you said. Does the documentary get into that whole effort, the Free Britney movement effort, and laying out what that is?
What happened is that someone placed an anonymous voicemail with people who do a podcast, and this anonymous voicemail said that Britney wanted to get out of the conservatorship. She wasn't getting along with her father. And then that sparked this avalanche of attention from fans. And there's a poignant sequence in the film where a bunch of fans sort of speak out. Let's listen to that clip.
Dear Britney.
Dear Britney.
Dear Britney.
We grew and we grew and we grew and we grew.
I support you. I stand by
Britney
you.
Spears needs our help.
Why is it so hard to get out of? Why is she still in it?
This is Rose McGowan saying, free Britney.
Free Britney!
Now, all of that is sort of an admirable response, but we really don't know anything about her mental health state. We really don't know anything about why the judges are making the decisions they're making. And so for people to stand up and say free Britney when they really have no idea what the situation is kind of frightening.
But ultimately, wouldn't you agree this documentary gives us a chance to assess and maybe reassess the media's involvement in the way we portrayed her and maybe take another look at the way we look at celebrities in general and our need to constantly know about every single detail of their lives?
Most definitely. And I think there's really like two things going on in this documentary. The first thing, which I think is incredibly affecting, is it explores the structure of building a pop music career for a young woman. Like how unfair, how sexist all of that was for her. But the other part of this film raises a bunch of amazing questions, but few of them get answered, and they're really crucial to understanding the conservatorship and whether she should be in it and how she's been treated while she's been under it.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking about the New York Times Presents documentary Framing Britney Spears, now on Hulu. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.